Okay, today is March 27th, 2014, and this is Karen Brewster here with Dave Klein at his home in Fairbanks, Alaska, continuing with our life history conversations. So, Dave, we think last time we left off, we were talking about your work in Petersburg in southeastern Alaska for Fish and Wildlife Service looking at the deer population. So maybe you can tell me more about that work.
Yeah, that actually the deer work, it started at about the biologists starting with the in territorial days. The first biologists were mostly in post-war years, and they then there was by that time there was money available through the federal aid in wildlife restoration legislation, the national legislation that was based on taxes on firearms and ammunition that supported the states and the territory and relationship to size and number of hunting licenses sold. So hunting and trapping licenses. So my job was technically, I was based in Petersburg, but all of southeast Alaska was my area of responsibility, primarily deer. But I had some other responsibilities related to hunting and fishing and game regulations and management of wildlife. For example, I had to do annual survey flights of moose on the Stikine River. And mountain goats, not much. I had a big interest because I'd done a master's degree on mountain goats. So I could provide a lot of information because I hunted them there with friends. And sometimes we'd do, if we're doing other aerial surveys on the mainland for deer, we might check out goat areas close to the sea. But it was mainly deer, and one of the big problems was how do you estimate the number of deer so that you know what trends are in population numbers over time, as well as how many deer are available. What is hunting pressure? Is it reasonable in terms of the numbers of deer? And the deer were known to fluctuate widely based upon extreme winters, the frequency of extreme winters, which was like once in every 5 to 10 years you'd have an extreme winter. And that would cause and heavy losses of deer through starvation because of the deep snow made food unavailable to the deer. And the old growth forests close to the beach were like the last place the deer would be pushed down close to the beach. But there was food there usually, but it's not a lot because it's old growth forest. But old growth was uneven aged and had holes in the canopy so the sun could get down there. So there were plants that were important as deer food, like blueberry shrubs. And on the forest floor itself, before the snow came in, a lot of low bush cranberry and the dwarf dogwood. And the leaves were good. They stayed green all winter long. And several other plants stayed green all winter long. So as long as there was no snow covering the ground, which is where when there was snow, it was mostly up higher elevations where it was cooler, and that was down low often melted off because of the rains that usually came at lower elevations when there was a storm. But in a severe winter, a cold winter, with then snows right down to the sea line was when there would be the big starvation loss.
So what you're saying is that the deer's main food source was this dogwood and blueberry and cranberry down near the coast,
At that time of the year,
and that when it snowed a lot, then their primary
there
food
was
source was.
still food available, if they were pushed down there by snow at high elevations. Uh-huh. But if you got snow down there, they could be so bad that it was hard for the deer to get around. The energy costs of moving through the snow meant that the fawns couldn't handle the deep snow and would die, and the first and then the old ones that were not in good shape. It was only the more vigorous ones. And then if the snow lasted for more than a couple of weeks, the deep snows, without rains washing it down and melting it, then we'd be massive die-offs of deer just dying on the beach, eating lower hemlock boughs or needles from the lower limbs of mm-hmm. these trees, which was like starvation food, eating some kelp that would wash up on the beach. They always ate a little bit of this stuff, but if it was hard to digest, and they would starve with full rumens, their stomach, poor stomach, and with this food that they couldn't digest well. They'd lose their microorganisms when in starvation and just couldn't digest this food.
So what was their regular main food source on a regular year when there wasn't a lot of snow?
It was, if there were deer down at lower elevations and there was no snow, there was a lot of what we called winter green vegetation, which were perennial plants trailing in the mossy layers of the forest, in the old growth forest, and in open areas in these forests where trees fall down and others have to take years to fill in. Mm-hmm. And so they had a wide variety. They ate the centers of ferns, overwintering ones, the fiddleheads on mm-hmm. ferns. They'd eat those. They were opportunistic, but they would select for food that was digestible mm-hmm. and suitable.
And what about the
willow browse? When the snow would cover the lower evergreen, then the blueberry and huckleberry, they're closely related vaccinium species, those were the main browse species. And if they'd eat the green shoots from the previous summer mm-hmm. growth, which was okay food. It wasn't as good as the winter greens that are covered by snow, but they'd eat these and could usually get through the winter. But you could see the browsing was heavy. And one of the first things I did was to build some exposures to keep the deer out from about 10 by 10 foot squares in forested areas as well as in more open areas. And those paid off right away, because we didn't realize they were eating these wintergreen things, because when they took these green leaves, they didn't kill the plant. And if they were gone by the end of winter, it just was some mossy forest floor vegetation left with a few shrubs growing up. And some of the shrubs they wouldn't eat, Devil's Club and what was called Buck's Brush, that didn't have berries in it, and it was resistant to being eaten because it was apparently very poorly digestible. But at any rate,
But so I would interrupt a second. The deer that lived higher up, what were they eating?
They would eating in the summertime, and if you can get up above tree line, that's the most lush deer habitat in summer, because it's nice and green, pasture-like situation with a lot of variety of plants, but typical alpine plants that are fast-growing, especially in the rainforest, heavy rainfall, lots of sunlight, and good growth conditions. But as many of those would be have annual growth above ground, so they were perennial plants, mm-hmm. but then there were also as you started coming down out of that alpine there would be, or there'd be things like sedges, a few sedges and grasses that would not die back and as like this in the wintertime. But that would, if you're on the mainland, then that's what mountain goats would be feeding on until the snow came. So then the deer would, when the snow came, the deer would start moving down, and the area in the timberline forest was very productive for deer food because there was a lot of sunlight there. The trees were small and scattered, and a lot of shrubs. That's where there were a lot of the blueberry shrubs, and they were the main browse species that was used in the early winter by the deer that are up there. High quality, they were growing out where they're getting a lot of sunlight. But that would, in southeast Alaska, that would quickly be covered by snow as the winter progressed. So they gradually moved down into the lower slopes, and the slopes would were good slopes, especially south slopes, where they could get more sunlight during the growth season. And they would just, it was a product of where the snow accumulated and how much. Mm-hmm. And you'd get different depths of snow too, because in a storm, frequently the precipitation was on mostly on the side of the mountain where the snow was, where the that the wind was blowing from. Mm-hmm. And whether it was rain or snow, it would tend to be deeper on those sides. So they moved around in relation, the deer moved around in relationship to the availability of food. And the snow was the main controlling factor, which of course was a product of the variability of the weather throughout the winter.
Okay, and that makes sense that
yeah.
the pressures of your food's covered by snow, so you keep moving down to the beach,
yeah.
and eventually if there's snow at the beach, you've got no more food left.
Right.
Right.
Okay. So wait, and these exposures, I only built about four of them in different parts of southeast, but mostly not too far from Petersburg, because we had to haul by boat the fencing and cut poles and what, and it was an all-day operation to build one of them. And then there were problems too, because if in the rainforest there was always a lot of limbs coming down, and those on a big old growth spruce or hemlock, those limbs are big and heavy, and they could break down the exposure quickly. And we had one case where, fortunately, we were checking that daily, and a branch came down and broke down the fence so that it leaned into the exposure, and deer walked in there and pushed the fence down because it was an angle, because there was more green vegetation inside that hadn't been eaten, and then couldn't get out.
Oh.
So it had plenty to eat while it was in there, which was only a matter of hours or so overnight and the next morning. And so we had this deer in the enclosure, which we put an ear tag in and let it escape. And but it was a problem in maintaining these, because oftentimes they'd be just crashed down on top of them, and there wouldn't be any fence left at all. And it'd be a big operation to, if it was a big tree, you couldn't do it. You couldn't, yeah. We didn't have big chainsaws to.
What time period was this, the 50s?
This was in the 50s, right.
Yeah, so you didn't have all the chainsaws.
Oh, there were, we might have a small chainsaw, but these were big logs, and these were small for cutting lumber and stuff.
Yeah.
If we're building a dock around town or working on your house or something. Yeah.
So for somebody who doesn't know about exclosures, maybe we can explain that. You built this fenced-in area to keep the deer out so the plants would grow so you could see
So we could
what
see
what deer were eating.
What effect the deer were having on the vegetation. In other words, they weren't eating all plants. They were eating those that they selected for. And they were the good ones for deer browse. And there were not so many outside because, say, the deer pressure was fairly high when the deer population was high. And especially if they were forced down in the early winter and feeding on the blueberries, they wouldn't. In some places, some islands that out toward the outer coasts, they didn't have so much snow, and so the deer, except at high elevations, so the deer would spend the whole winter down at low elevations. And there, an exposure after a few years, you could see that we're getting real. The forest would have been super, without the deer, would have been super brushy and hard to walk through, but it was open and park-like underneath the trees. In some cases, there wasn't good reproduction of hemlock, particularly. Hemlock can get started growing on top of dead logs, for example, and they're called nursery logs, a tree that falls over and gets mossy. They get started there. Where the deer pressure was high, those are edible, the young trees. But once they get big, then of course they can't feed on them. Sitka spruce, they normally will not eat Sitka spruce. Although in extreme cases, there was some, we found Coronation Island where there were no wolves and no hunting, and the deer were controlled by the food supply, and they're therefore controlled the food supply and eliminated virtually eliminated all of the good quality food. So you'd only find, say, blueberries growing up on a dead stump where it was decomposing and enough soil there, but the deer couldn't climb up on that stump to feed on, or on cliffs and rocky places that the deer couldn't get to.
So in your exclosures, if there was lots of one type of plant that was growing really tall, that was different, that same plant was not seen outside of the exclosure, you knew the deer was eating that.
Yeah, that's right. Okay. So the terminology is confusing here. Generally, you use the term enclosures to enclose the vegetation.
But you were excluding the deer.
That's right, and that's why we tended to use the term exclosure for excluding deer.
But a botanist might call it an enclosure because they were studying
that's right.
something inside.
Yeah, and we were doing that too, but our purpose was to keep the deer out. In some areas, when you build exclosures or enclosures for moose, for example, in the Kenai Peninsula or other places, you have to consider the other herbivores like snowshoe hares. So you might have to have a fencing that will keep out both the moose, which have to be pretty tall, and then would keep out the snowshoe hares. Mm-hmm. And there's always a few herbivores in there that you're not going to keep out, like voles, which may be eating the seeds of these trees or plants, which is how plants get started. But there's a limit to what you can do with an enclosure or right. exclosure.
And I've heard it used as the term exclosure when I've heard scientists talk about this kind of work, I've heard them use the word exclosure.
Yeah, right. And the one of the main reasons at the time, as a young biologist, I was sort of typical, I want quick solutions to problems. And the exclosure is, in many cases, other than this wintergreen vegetation that we found, it only took one winter, and then we saw that difference. But mostly for the woody browse, like the blueberries and related plants, it might take 10 years before you could see the difference. And they're slower growing, and you had to have the control was outside, the rest of the area outside, and then you had this. So you had to have an enclosure that was be sustained and managed to last for 10 years without getting broken down by the windfalls. But deer didn't push fences over like if you build enclosures and they have for bison or moose. Yeah, they can push over a fence if there's food inside, and it isn't fence, it's not built to withstand them doing that. You build an enclosure for bison, for example, use railroad ties for posts, because they may rub against them too.
So what did you use for posts for the deer?
We just cut smaller poles and trees and that were available close to where we were working. Yeah.
And we didn't say, but these are Sitka black-tailed deer, is that correct?
These are Sitka black-tailed deer.
Okay.
And, right. But then we had, Southeast Alaska is just a terrific place to study deer ecology and the deer ecosystem relationships of the deer. And the reason is that you have all these peculiar distribution of the predators in relationship to the deer. Like the northern islands in Southeast, the Admiralty, Baranof, and Chichagof Islands, they're called the ABC Islands, they have much more pronounced winter with deeper snows because they're further north. But they also have no wolves present. They have deer, no wolves. There are brown bears there, but no black bears. On the mainland, there's black bears and brown bears both present, southeast. Now you go further south, the next group of islands, so the middle ones with Petersburg is Kubrinov and Mitkov and Edelin, where Wrangell and Petersburg are. In the middle islands, there's wolves. They're close to the mainland, and the wolves could swim and get to the islands from the mainland. There's black bears, but no brown bears on those islands in southern and southeast Alaska. Just black bears of the bears species. And there's a really long and complex history of how they got there differentially, and how long some have been there longer than others, and were there refugia? Well, when I was there, the geologists claimed that the southeast Alaska was totally covered, except for a few nunataks sticking through the ice caps with ice, and therefore there couldn't be any refugia for mammals and birds and humans.
So what's refugia? It's a place they take refuge.
A refuge is where, refugia is a term used for an area with regard to glaciation that wasn't glaciated.
Okay.
And you could have plants that would have been there through the glacial period. And if it's a big enough refugee, you could have animals that would be living there in a whole ecosystems.
So it was during the glaciation period, it's a part that didn't get glaciated.
That was the hypothesis. And this was based mainly on geologists studying rocks, mostly in the mountains that didn't have snow on them in the summer. And they'd see that there obviously was glaciers overriding much of the mountains, unless there are real tall mountains, or in lower elevations, everything was covered by vegetation usually, but so you couldn't examine rocks unless at the beach there might be a reef that hadn't eroded down, and some of those would have glacial scarring from glaciers. So it was an assumption that there were no refugees. Subsequently, it was shown, well, first with some pollen analysis in marshy areas, in ponds and in swamps, they showed that there were species of plants that must have been in refugia because they don't occur, didn't occur outside of the area. And then they into the limestone caves, mainly on Prince of Wales Island, which is the largest island in southern, in the southern group of islands down west of Ketchikan. That had a lot of limestone and karst topography, which is limestone substrate where you have sinkholes and caverns and caves. Mm-hmm. And in these caves, which frequently had openings to the, through a sinkhole from the top, animals over thousands of years had fallen in, and so their bones were present, and they were able to date the bones and tell when deer arrived, when brown bears and deer were both present there in southern southeast at one time. Hmm. Why the brown bears died out, we don't know there, and why they don't haven't come back into southeast from the mainland. Occasional one would be in there, and my hypothesis then was the bears that were there first had priority, even though the black bears are usually subordinate to brown bears because they're smaller. The diets were different, and they were able to do stable isotope analysis on the bones, showing that the black bears were eating forest plants and berries and some animal matter, some fish, but the brown bears that were down there at the same time were eating almost all animals, including fish and mammals and birds coming from the sea. Hmm. So they were all animals that lived in the sea or that lived on the production of the sea. So these are advances that have occurred since I left.
Yeah, but like Admiralty Island, I think of as a place that has big brown bears.
Yes, and the Admiralty Island bears are and particularly fascinating because it was hard to explain why there were brown bears there and we knew that they didn't normally swim the long distances to the mainland, even though there are brown bears on the mainland. But we figured that maybe lowered sea levels, they didn't have as wide a distance to swim. But then you had to factor in the glaciers. What was we were able to find, though, from genetic work, and some of that was done, the first was done through the university here, where we had a faculty member who was
a geneticist,
and he had a student, Sandra Talbot, who was at a PhD with him. And they started looking at tissue samples from the brown bears and on the mainland as well as in southeast Alaska. And they found that the brown bears on the ABC Islands in southeast Alaska were the most different from other brown bears throughout the whole world. Because brown bears occur across Siberia, all the way down into Hungary and in Scandinavia, and they're all very closely related, with the exception, they're all closely related, but the ones in southeast Alaska are less closely related to the mainland and animals than, even though you have the Barren Ground Grizzly, which is a brown bear, and the big Kodiak brown bear, they're genetically close together than the southeast Alaska brown bears, which were big because as well as the other coastal brown bears on Kodiak and the Alaska Peninsula, largely because of the abundance of fish that they were able to have available to feed on. But genetically, they had been separated for a long time. And the Southeast Alaska, this is a mystery that has not been adequately explained as yet, is that the Southeast Alaska brown bears were more closely related, the most closely of the brown bears related to polar bears.
Hmm.
So the question is, how many hundreds of thousands of years ago were the polar bears separate from the brown bears? I think when they were first doing these studies and finding this difference, it was estimated that it was about 350,000 years ago that the polar bears and brown bears separated. I think more recent studies suggest it might have been longer than that.
Hmm. Interesting. It got us off the subject of your deer.
Well, but yes and no.
Related,
I did.
I'm sure.
I had some responsibilities for bears, but mainly it was on Admiralty Baranof and Chichikov, where we got into argument with the Forest Service because they were wanting to log everywhere that they could, and their whole attitude. Forest Service at that time, even though it was supposedly a national, the Forest Service was a multiple resource management agency, and they talked about managing all of the resources on the land rather than just focusing on one. The reality was that they didn't have any biologists at that time working for them. They were all loggers and foresters, and they knew a lot about cruising timber and what is ready to be cut and how to go about estimating the board feet of timber so that they could lease land for logging, and they wanted to get old growth forests into what they saw, the foresters saw, as better production. You're producing more fiber per year on second growth forests than you are in old growth forests, because a lot of the trees are falling down and decomposing and not being harvested. But
we're still,
of course,
having those arguments.
Pardon?
We still have those same arguments today.
Of course they are. And so I was working for the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Forest Service, another federal agency. We had a hard time relating to them. We related more closely to the state government and the Alaska Department of Fish and Game after statehood than we did with the Forest Service. And even before statehood, we had a lot of disagreements with the Forest Service because technically we had responsibility, Fish and Wildlife Service had responsibility for the well-being of the wildlife, and which should be managed properly in relationship to the harvest of other resources from the forest.
So even though it was national forest land, Fish and Wildlife Service had responsibility for the wildlife.
Wildlife and the fish. And that for salmon, that meant it was Forest Service land, and technically the Forest Service had responsibility for the streams and what. It was the Fish and Wildlife Service and the Bureau of Commercial Fisheries that wanted to be sure that spawning streams were protected and when logging occurred. And so they were arguing for, you know, protecting the spawning streams, don't cut close to them. And that was, because if you cut and just left big trees close to the streams, then the next storm would usually blow them down because they would not be protected by other trees. And that would be a worst case scenario, because then it would be a tangle and it might even obstruct salmon moving up through the streams and be costly for the forests to salvage that wood and clear them out.
So you needed a certain width of a buffer.
That's right. And it varied because of the shape of the landscape. Some areas are so exposed and vulnerable to strong winds that it was very hard to do logging successfully in those places. You might, in some of those cases, they could make an argument for clearing all the trees out so that, and live with warmer water temperatures until you got regrowth of the new forests that shade the waters and the whole watershed. And water temperature was crucial for the success of the salmon spawning eggs and the young salmon in the sea. So it was, and of course this was a big industry, commercial fishing, as well as, and a young forest logging industry was just getting started. And so, and technically the Forest Service was managing in a way to be detrimental to the money-making industry at the time, to get another one started, and to and subsidizing road building and what, so that the loggers could buy the get a lease, and on the basis of the stumpage and how much wood there was available, and they had to lower the price. These resources were property of all American citizens, and yet they were sort of catering to special interests. Mm-hmm. And Northwestern loggers were clear-cutting most of the rainforest down there, and they saw Southeast Alaska as a place to come, which they did. They had made deals with the Japanese to build two pulp mills, one at Ketchikan, one at Sitka, and that's where most of the logging was went there. They were also had very lax laws to allow rough timber to be shipped to Japan directly from Southeast Alaska without any processing and without creating very many jobs except cutting the trees down. Gradually there were some changes made in that regard. But back to the bears on Admiralty and Baranof and Chitka, and there were problems that the Forest Service had, and they tended to blame Fish and Wildlife Service on the fact that the brown bears were coming into logging camps where loggers were small-scale loggers, where there were two or three families, and the women and children were there, and mess hall, and they frequently were the best place to locate was the mouth of a salmon stream, which attracted the bears, and they were damaging the salmon stream, attracting bears because they weren't disposing their garbage properly, and then their children, and they were at risk of injury by the bears. And so the Forest Service attitude, acknowledged at that time by the chief forester, was on closed doors, it wasn't for the press when we met with him, was, well, you wildlifers have to face up to the fact that bears are going to have to go. They're just not compatible with logging and with our primary use of the forest, from their perspective, primary use.
Right.
So we did some studies jointly with the Forest Service to try to identify how many bears there were on a given salmon stream during the spawning time when bears tended to concentrate there, because the loggers claimed there weren't many bears. We claimed there were a lot of bears, and they were mostly staying on the stream, and they said that they were moving between the streams, and so it looked like there were more bears than there actually were. And so we did some studies. We did measured tracks and differentiated moderately well how many different bears were on salmon streams, which was we had a Forest Service boats and Fish and Wildlife boats that we were based on, and we moved around, and then we had helicopter and float plane. Helicopters would move a team of two people. Two of us would be flown up to where they could land on at the head of a salmon stream, on a muskeg, or if a stream is wide enough, on a gravel bar, and drop us off. And we had one person would be carrying a bear gun, and the other person would have a clipboard and tape measure, and we'd be measuring and recording tracks as we came down in the stream sands, along the stream, or any place where we could find tracks, all the way down to the sea, And then we'd get picked up again and moved around either by boat back to our, by a small boat back to our big boats, and then settled back up to the head of other streams. So you do a couple of streams a day, a team of two people. So we had quite a few teams of and some of them were Forest Service people, but I was responsible for coordinating all this, and we worked together with them, and it was a good project. We published a paper on the method we used and estimates of the deer. And so we made a strong case for that there were more deer on those islands, more
bears.
Brown bears on those islands, that they were a unique resource. And although it wasn't until some years later when the National Interest Land and Conservation Act, ANILCA, protected the Admiralty Island as a national monument, largely because of the richness for brown bears there.
And that was partially then based on your research?
Some of that, yes, definitely. But there were continuing studies done with the bears and the deer on those islands.
So your research showed that there were more brown bears there than what the loggers were saying?
Yep. It wasn't just a matter of scaring a few bears away from camp. And it was obvious. There were some things were quite obvious, like there were bears were tied to the salmon during the spawning period. And the bears were playing more studies, and some Forest Service studies were beginning to show that the bears were moving, were spending a lot of time on the banks of the salmon streams, where they would pull the fish up after they were spawned out or they had eaten part of them, and they would decompose and be spread around further by gulls and ravens and small mammals and other animals eating them, and that the nutrients from the sea was being brought in by the salmon that died after they spawned, and some of them were killed by bears certainly before they spawned, but at least the nutrients were entering the whole watershed because the bears were moving around. They were spreading also berries by eating berries along the stream and spreading those seeds, berry seeds, out. And studies done through the Forest Science Laboratory in Juneau, which was a product of the Pacific North Forest and Range Research Station, which was the research branch of the Forest Service, they were able to show this good connection between the salmon. And some of our students here, my own students, were also involved in these studies. With using stable isotopes, we were able to show how important the marine resources were to much of the plant and animal life on these islands in Southeast Alaska. And that remains the initial cutting edge science that is built on by that, and realize that Pacific salmon is so unique for Alaska, enriching the whole ecosystems of the land, as well as moving back to the sea and growing and coming back again and after their cycle time.
Well, I think our conversation is showing how interconnected this all is from an ecosystem perspective, considering we just went from deer to bear to salmon.
Yeah. We can go back to deer again, and then I'll get to where I went to.
Well, that was my question. So this work you were doing with the exclosures, what did that show you, and how was that useful?
Well, I think I mentioned earlier that I, as an undergraduate student, I took quite a bit of botany. Mm-hmm. And was always interested in botanic and gardening and plants, and as well as the wildlife. And so my interest in the deer, well, the exclosures were part of that, were, you know, what kind of plants are most important, and what plant communities are important to the deer, and they're used, I know they were used differently in different seasons of the year, and how do they affect the nutrition and growth of the deer. So I mean, you can say that food that the animals eat are going to affect two aspects of the animals, of herbivores. One is it's going to affect the population of them, because then that's a matter of how much quality forage is available in the given area to allow the population to grow successfully, to reproduce, and go through tough winters and then grow to good size. And the other was the body size of the animal themselves is going to be a function to some extent of the quality of the food. And that became apparent through hunting, and they would have, in some of the towns, they would have a trophy for the largest, the heaviest deer that was killed, that was brought out, where in the usual way the deer are relatively small, and so you can, the average size female, you can make a pack, just the whole animal, by just eviscerating it and leave the head and feet on, and eviscerating it and sew it back up again, put the heart and lungs and liver back inside, sew it up with some twine and a pocket knife, and then you can carry it like a pack on your back.
And what, like a 100-pound pack or a 50-pound pack?
You could, it would be, a female would be a 70-pound, probably, a 75-pound. A buck would be over 100, and the big bucks, the biggest bucks, would be up in the 100. This is with the viscera out, but the rest of the animal there, mm-hmm. skin and all, head and antlers, and that would be a big one would be over 150 pounds, sometimes a little higher than that.
And that's with the head and the antlers, or without those?
Head and antlers.
Okay.
The whole animal without the viscera, so that would be the guts and the guts, and that.
Yeah.
And so then, but then there were islands, smaller islands that were fairly isolated, hard to get to, that didn't have any deer. And those southern groups of islands, didn't have any wolves, where there were wolves on these other islands. So I was fascinated by the fact that this one island close to Wrangell, which is a good-sized island, but small compared to the big islands of Wrangell Island and Edelin that were close by, or Mitkoff, where Petersburg was on. And Warenkovsky Island had a lot of alpine area, not much lowland, and it had big deer, and the wolves were there sometimes, but they could swim across to Edelin, that was a narrow channel, and move back and forth sort of in relationship to availability of deer. But in the summertime, the deer were scattered out, and in mountainous area are hard for wolves to prey on. Plus, in the summertime, they're raising their young, and they're staying down low, and they're usually not hunting in packs until winter time.
The wolves,
you mean? The wolves. Yeah. So here there's an island with a big deer and wolves and good quality food, but the population fluctuated markedly because it was close to the mainland, close to the Stikine River, where you had a colder influence coming in from the interior in wintertime, and you had heavier and deeper snows for longer periods of time. So it was a case, when you had severe winters, again, available food was covered virtually, and they didn't have the lowland overwintering areas like some of the other islands had. And so the population would fluctuate, and in a period of mild winters, you'd have lots of deer and good hunting, and there were big, giant deer that were winning trophies for being large body size. The outer, then if you go straight out to the west coast, there's a Coronation Island, which was had no wolves on it, and it was hard to explain why there were no wolves on it, because it was a narrow channel between Kiu Island to the north, but it was a very dangerous channel for boating because the waves and currents were strong there, so it probably discouraged swimming by wolves. It didn't have any bears on it either, of either sex. There were closely black bears on other islands and wolves. And the deer there were, obviously they were not, they were in the, and it was kind of a isolated place so that most hunters didn't go that way. Occasional fishermen would go into one of the bays and anchor up and then might go hunting. But there was essentially no human harvest. So deer there, the winters were milder because they're out by the maritime coast. So that I started this study comparing the vegetation on these two islands. The deer were small there, and there were lots of them. They were less wary and easy to hunt because there were no predators.
That was on Coronation. They were smaller and less wary?
Yeah, right.
Okay.
And so but then the vegetative studies showed that the high-quality forage plants had been eliminated by this long, heavy pressure of deer without a lot of snow, and so there wasn't good. They sometimes would, in a rare winter, but it would, there was a rare winter would be once every 20 years or so. Then there might be a fair reduction. But mostly they died because they were in poor condition going into the winter, and they had a slower growth rate, and probably not as many females successfully raised their calves through going into the first winter, their fawns. And in the vegetation, you know, showed this effect, but you don't see it because it was uniform. Subsequently, this was funded, my studies were funded by the Department of Fish and Game after statehood. Before that, it was the Fish and Wildlife Service, but I was just getting started. So then, when 1959, when Alaska became a state, and I was had started this work, I decided I wanted to go back to university and get a PhD because I thought ultimately I wanted to be at a university and need a PhD degree. So I made a deal with I quit the Fish and Wildlife because there was no place for me to stay in Alaska. I would have had to transfer out of Alaska if I wanted to stay with Fish and Wildlife because they were cutting back. It was a new state was building up the Department of Fish and Game, and so the jobs that we had as biologists with the Department of Fish and Game in the territorial days were eliminated, and the state then took over this responsibility. I then transferred to Fish and Game, and most of the people that made up the game division, a large percentage of them were from students, graduates of our program here at the University of Alaska, like myself. So I knew quite a few of them, and they were, I think they did a good job of organizing, and they had good role models from the federal work that we're doing. And there were several others that were with the federal that transferred to the state. And so that it was a good transition, a good cooperation between state and federal during this transition period. And the federal government took a lot of responsibility for the habitat studies before, because virtually all the habitat was under federal control, whether it was national forests or national wildlife refuges or national Bureau of Land Management, public domain lands, and it was before statehood, and the state hadn't had time to select lands, nor the natives. There hadn't been a native claim settlement, so the native, there weren't areas selected by the natives. And so the new Department of Fish and Game put emphasis on county animals and population, studying population dynamics of the animals on the basis of working with the animals, rather than studying both the habitat and the relations of the animals to habitat. So my experience and training had been to, through the Fish and Wildlife Service, had been looking at habitat animals and plant relationships through habitat, and then the well-being of the population and the growth of the individual animals, etc. This kind of studies were only continued then in places like the wildlife refuges, where the it was all under federal control, and national parks, some studies there, but mostly there weren't those studies being started at that time. And so I took, I was able to take a leave without pay, educational leave, they called it, and to go back to the University of British Columbia to do a PhD, because they were doing the kind of studies with deer that I was interested in and I was starting, and I'd collaborated with them on some of the getting animals down to them for their studies. And the major, Dr. Ian McTaggart Cowan, who was head of the department, biology department, also was my major advisor, and he was the one who was managing and started the studies on the deer, that including Sitka blacktail, some of the fawns I had provided that were orphan fawns and picked up by people thinking they were orphaned, at least, and we had to have, we had to take care of him for a while, but then we shipped him down, and he used those in his deer studies. But I felt it was the best place for me to go, and he was an ideal professor to advise me. And I could move down with my new family and two children, young children, and I spent the two winters then in Vancouver during the academic years, and came back in the summers, and my wife and children came down with me, and then in the summer they would go to Washington State in Walla Walla, where my wife's family lived, and they'd stay with the grandparents during the summer, then come back to the campus when I came back.
And so your summers, you came back to Alaska and
I came back and continued to do field work on and trying to finish up these studies, but it was an overlapping with a young biologist who was just got his degrees at the University of Alaska in Fairbanks. And so we worked together. He was sort of my field assistant, but he was learning his responsibilities through working with me.
And who was that?
That was Harry Merriam.
Okay. And so I'm going to sidetrack us a little bit, because you mentioned a wife and family. And where did they come from?
In Petersburg, I had been single and definitely didn't want to get settled down. I had the military, the service that I had to do, and I didn't have a job or income or savings when I was a student in the military. But I moved to Petersburg and had a full-time job then, and then I met a school teacher, a young school teacher in Petersburg who was originally from Washington State, and she and I got together and we got married. And And we had our first two children there.
And what was her name?
Arlaine, A-R-L-A-Y-N-E. Her last name was Knox before. No, it wasn't Knox. It was Brown.
So how did you meet her?
Well, actually, it was through wives of pilots. I mean, I knew the pilots that flew. I was doing a lot of flying between southeast towns with the deer management, checking with hunters and determining what they killed, et cetera, et cetera, and collecting draws for age studies. And so at that time, you flew only with Grumman Goose and landed in the harbor. There are no airports except at Juneau and Ketchikan. Closest airport was on an island.
That was Annette Island.
Annette Island, and you'd have to fly there, a short flight from Ketchikan to get there. So at any rate, so I know these pilots, and then there was a pilot who flew for, had a charter company with small planes, and I use him a lot for deer counts or moose counts. Bill Stedman, he's a terrific pilot, very good and safe pilot. Some of the winter counts, so he'd be dealing with turbulent weather, and he was good about cutting off when it got too turbulent before he and I might get sick. I never had any problems with air sickness, but he knew how to do the kind of survey work. And he had a wife who was a school teacher. So, and then his pilot, one of the pilots' wife was a school teacher that flew for the airlines. There were two companies, one based in Ketchikan and one in Juneau, and Alaska Coastal Airlines. And the one in Ketchikan was, I'll think of it.
I know I will have heard of it, but I can't think of it.
And they worked together, really, and moved people and mail and other things back and forth. And so no ferry system then. And
oh, really?
And no, things came in by either the produce and stuff came in by the once a month, the Alaska Steamship Company came up from Seattle and stopped at the towns and dropped off food products and stuff. And but of course we had the fish processing companies there, shrimp fishing, salmon fishing, halibut fishing, a lot of diversity of food and good food. And but any fresh, I didn't have a lot of fresh produce. And the airlines were not capable of hauling that stuff because of the costs would be prohibited, or the small planes just handling baggage and passengers was, plus the logistics of loading and unloading was, didn't make freighting that way realistic. So
so you met Arlene through these other...
Yeah, socially.
It was a small town.
A small town, very small town. And the single young people were brought together by some of these school teachers and what, that and friends that I had met. And so that worked out.
And so the two children you had there were which of your children?
The Martin, the son, the first one and the oldest, and then Peggy Ellen.
Okay. So they were the two ones at that time period?
Born in Petersburg, yep.
Okay.
in the hospital there.
And who then went to BC with you guys?
Yep. That was the case. And so this, it was an exciting life for them as they got, we went by ship, then to Seattle. The government ship was coming down through. We were able to get a ride down. And then we bought a first new car, which I'd ever bought, was a VW Bug, and picked it up in Seattle. And so that was very efficient for us. It was efficient for that small family and for living in Washington State and Vancouver, British Columbia.
So what year was it that you started at UBC?
59.
That's right, okay, statehood. And when were Martin and Peggy Ellen born?
This is You're going to ask the difficult questions.
Never mind, I can find that out. But before 1959.
Yeah, yeah. Because we got married in 1950, around Christmas time, 55, I think. And so I'd only been down there for about a year. And and then Martin was born the next year. and a year and a half later, Peggy Ellen was born.
Okay, we can do the math. So you mentioned going in to these other communities and talking with the hunters, and that part of, so part of your work was this research and these exposures, but you also were dealing with
management.
More management.
Yeah, there were game wardens, and technically we had a game warden, a law enforcement authority, but our policy was we didn't want to exercise it except in an emergency, because we wanted the hunters to cooperate with us, and we didn't want them to think we were just other game wardens. So, but we worked closely with the game wardens, and frequently they were helping me in the field, and if they had the time, and I was doing the same, and they usually had a priority in for using the boat, a big boat that we could sleep on, but we. Most trips, organized trips, we would plan to do my own research in conjunction with theirs. But it was more the management kind. Where were the hunters hunting, and what was their hunter success in different areas, and what sex and age of deer were they killing, and the deer populations were in good shape and fairly high. And in fact, they were high enough that I could see pronounced effects with these exposures on mm-hmm. the vegetation of the deer, and was making the case that we should be very liberal with hunting. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, the Fish and Wildlife Service was carrying on predator control, and were killing wolves, because there was a separate branch, predator and rodent control, which in the early days in Alaska, the idea was that all wolves kill game, mm-hmm. and so they said wolves should be killed because we want the game for humans, except on parks or protected areas, and so. They were given credit for the numbers of animals, of wolves they killed, and coyotes as well, where they're killing coyotes. And they, rather than where the killing wolves where it might be needed, because the deer population was pushed down, say, by the severe weather, and then you had good weather, and they were slow to come back because there were still a lot of wolves there. So they didn't concentrate the control in the areas where it's needed. There were more wolves where there were more deer. And so they killed the wolves. And that was true throughout the whole territory. And then later the state, it was somewhat similar until predator and rodent control was pretty much dissolved with statehood.
Okay, so predator and rodent control was part of Fish and Wildlife?
Yes. So I was working, sometimes predator and rodent control agents, there was one station in Petersburg, one in Wrangell, and they moved around southeast somewhat. But yeah, we worked together frequently. I didn't do their control work, but I frequently was there when they were doing control work. Mm-hmm. And I was already the young biologist and the territory at that time, myself and others, and in the Department of Fish and Game, were wanting to get away from poisoning wolves, poisoning any animals. That was not as selective as was desired, and in theory they were trying to be as selective as possible. But like they would fly in a small plane, and if you had a freeze up early of the lakes in southeast in the winter, the wolves would frequently move around on the islands and use the frozen lakes. Well, they would make up these baits and plastic bags and drop them from the plane, and they would burst, and the baits were chunks of seal blubber with
poison?
Strychnine.
Oh.
Tablets. And they, when they hit the ice, they'd burst open and scatter this brown spot of terrible smelling stuff for at least for humans. And then wolves would be attracted to that, and they would eat it. And bears by then should have been in hibernation, and most other smaller mammals would not be out in the middle of the lake. And so the wolves would normally hang around there long enough to die right there, and they could go out and pick them up. But that would only work well if you had an early freeze up of the lake. Often the lakes didn't freeze up until there was a lot of snow, and the wolves wouldn't be using the lakes for movement. And then they, other times, they just would set baits along the coast above high tide. And they would usually kill a seal, and seals were not protected then because they ate salmon. At least that's the argument. And they also made it hard in the mouth when gill netters fishing at the mouth of the Sikkim River, mm-hmm. or Taka or other major rivers where the salmon would school up, getting ready to go up with the tide. Seals would move in and feed there, but the fishermen didn't like them particularly because they would take fish out of their nets, mm-hmm. or take big bites out of the fish in their nets.
So the seals were a target for this predator control because of that, or they were a...
They were more of a target for the fishing industry, fishermen, mm-hmm. but predator control was given the responsibility to do that.
Right.
And so they just, they didn't think that probably the territorial people as well as the Fish and Wildlife in general didn't want random killing of seals by predator and rodent control people, but they were not protected. So they were fair game to use for bait for killing wolves. And they would just pull up the whole seal and cut it open, and then they'd have these baits made out of seal blubber that we seals they'd killed for this purpose, and with fermented mix it in with fermenting herring and other fish, and then they put these, scattered these around and inside the carcass of the seal. Mm-hmm. And this was a little more difficult because the wolves would travel along the beast line, and if they would pick something up, they might just move along the beach. And they were getting, some eagles were being killed. Eagles weren't protected until 1951 or something like that, in Southeast Alaska. And, or they were protected nationally then. Before that, the eagles were also bountied by the territorial government, and you could get, I don't know how much it was about $1.50 for a pair of eagle feet. And then the territorial legislators did put a bounty on seals in Southeast Alaska, and that was, you could turn in the scalp of a seal skin, and with the eyes and nose on it, and get paid probably $5 each, something like that. And that was passed by the territorial legislature, and then I think it was the territorial legislature. And then when there were a lot of, course, some natives involved in Southeast, but that time were probably more non-natives than natives Southeast. But native people on the north coast of Alaska then heard about paying $5 for a scalp of a seal, and they said, "This is unfair to us. We have to hunt seals and for subsistence living, and we don't have any cash economy. We should get $5 for each of the seals we killed, because we're not going to overkill them."
Right.
So it was a welfare.
They were killing them for food, and in Southeast they were being killed because they were pests.
That's right. But from a perspective of those people on the North Coast, they saw the bounty as welfare.
Right.
Which it was to some extent. And the wolves that were being bountied at the same time, then trappers got a good price. I forget how much it was. It was significant, like $25 or something.
I thought at some point it was up to $50.
Yeah. It was significant, and the hides were valuable. So, but it's like, you know, we should be treating the natives fairly.
So what happened? Did the natives in the north get that $5?
I think, and then it was repealed shortly later, but there were no very organized environmental groups at that time in Alaska, which would have pointed out the illogical basis for doing what they did.
Well, eventually that's what happened with the wolf bounty, how that got eliminated. Was the wolf bounty federal, or was it the territorial legislature?
It was territorial legislature, but it was technically the in territorial days, it was the game division, which was the mechanism through which the federal government operated. Mm-hmm. So the chairman of the game commission was the head of Fish and Wildlife Service in Alaska. And when I was there, it was Clarence Road then. And so we had good input, us young biologists, in our annual meetings of the fish and wildlife people with the game commission commissioners. And it wasn't that easy to get rid of the bounty, because this was a legislative thing, and the one key legislator from Nome said he would never vote for elimination of bounties on when the animal, he hated one animal, and that was Wolverine. Mm-hmm. He'd been a trapper on the Seward Peninsula. And so the trappers didn't want them to be bounded, but he wanted the Wolverine to be bounded. And he was so hard-nosed about this that they voted a bounty on the Wolverine, and they were able to get rid of the bounty then on the seals. I think it was that trade-off at the same time. He agreed that this didn't make sense. Of course, this was a different time, and he was a white man in Nome, and an old trapper, and yet the native interests weren't represented in the territorial legislature at all at that time.
Right.
It was, I shouldn't say at all, there was probably one from Southeast. Yeah, there was from Heidelberg. Well, I can't remember his name.
Yeah, but not equal representation, right. That's for sure. Well, you mentioned something about the wolf predator control and where it was happening versus not where it should be happening.
Yeah.
That they weren't getting rid of the wolves in the right places. Well, can you explain that a little bit more? How do you know what's the right way to do it?
It's partly that in Southeast Alaska, for example, I was telling the hunters and the game commission that we should liberalize the season because there's really too many deer and especially in the central part where Petersburg were and central part of Southeast and the northern part, but there weren't any wolves on the Admiralty, Baranof, and Chichikov in the northern part, so there wasn't an issue there. But and in Ketchikan area, yeah, the deer populations were lower, and they didn't. They thought any wolves were bad because there weren't very many deer, and that we didn't know the deer wolf relationship very well at that time. But you can make the assumption that was somewhat valid that where there's a lot more deer and there were a lot more wolves, and yeah, there were wolves. Sometimes you could hear them howling across the channel from where we lived in Petersburg. You could hear them howling moonlit night, a pack of wolves over there, and they were living on the deer. And so the idea was, the old school idea was that wolves were killing deer and hunters should be killing deer, not if they're going to do it. But the hunters had a very liberal, you could kill four deer a year, and that, so if a family with more than one hunter, that's a lot of deer. Mm-hmm. Plus, those people were fishermen and they had lots of fish too, and they lived off the land a lot, and so they didn't, and hunting was, you had to go by boat and generally to hunt deer, and it was an expedition, so it was okay, you had a lot of good hunting, but you also had to make a living fishing and doing other things, and hunters were satisfied with the liberal season, and it was either sex, so they could shoot does as well as bucks. And the idea of they still were not controlling the deer population through hunting, and that the deer were having a pronounced effect on the vegetation, and so lowering the future carrying capacity of the habitat by being at such a high density, and yet at the same time wolves were being bounded. And okay. Predator and rodent control people were, and we couldn't make the case then for there being a lot of deer, because they would say, well, the only time you see so many deer is when there's snow, and they're all pushed down to the beach, and which it's true to some extent, but there's an awful lot of beech. And it wasn't always on the, every beech was not the same, of course.
Right.
And we do follow-up studies of counting the number of deer remains, carcasses of those that starved, and we could differentiate between wolf kills versus starved deer. And so we did, you know, collected that information and made it available and did published one paper in the with the fellow that was that I had replaced when I first went down there. We started it, and but it was on winter mortality of deer, and it was based somewhat on our aerial surveys along beach lines and then walking these beaches back into the woods where the deer would die. That was, you know, we could do it locally with a skiff, an outboard of two people, and you know, one person would go ashore and start walking about a mile, and the other person would go up the shore 2 miles and anchor the boat out and start walking back and to the half mile, and then start walking the same direction as the first person. And then when the first person got up to the where the boat was anchored out, he would pull it in and motor up and either pick up the other guy or anchor the boat out and do another mile. But when you're out away, we'd have to go on a big boat, and that was a bigger operation, and you did it somewhat differently, but we used a skiff, and the big boat could move along mm-hmm. with us and speed up things. And it was selective beaches
right.
on different islands to get an idea of relative numbers. You could never actually count. We tried it to mark and release and then recapture, but in those days we weren't that efficient and couldn't do it with the conditions we had, and never has been done. The best estimates of deer populations have been pellet group counts in the winter time in winter range areas. So you do it in after the snow melts and the areas where they're wintering, a typical winter, and that gives you trends at least, because you could extrapolate to some extent to numbers of deer, but you could also extrapolate from year to year as to numbers of deer that were using that area on the basis of pellet group counts. And that meant, you know, going with the team and walking transects through there. And I used to go down with students from here and join up with Fish and Game people, and we would help them do some of these counts so that they would, the students would see how it was done. And of course, it was in springtime when it was really beautiful to be down there.
And by pellet count, you're talking about you're counting the poop, that kind of pellet?
Yep. Now, you don't necessarily gather them all. Yeah, you count the drops, it's a pellet group.
Mm-hmm.
So
you know that's one deer.
That's one deer, but there may be more than one. We had to do some basis of captive animals and feeding to know how many times they poop mm-hmm. per day.
Okay.
Yep.
But so the thing about the killing wolves is, so in that area around Petersburg, there were a lot of deer, and the hunters were getting enough deer, but predator control unit still was wanting to go out and kill wolves, even though they
that
had
was their job.
No
that
impact on the deer population.
That was their job, and they got, in their annual report, they would be able to say how many wolves they killed. And so there was, in relationship to their budget, the more wolves they killed, the more justification for them to go on existing.
Mm-hmm.
And so it wasn't until, and there were some cases where the Fish and Wildlife Service in territorial times relative to, say, caribou and other, and maybe moose, that we're starting to get predator and rodent control to agree to do wolf control only in those areas where we could say there's a real need for it, and stop controlling. And they were using also, in those areas, they were, weren't using the same kind of poisoning technique. They were using cyanide guns, which are called coyote getters.
Oh.
You have this metal pipe that you can drive into the ground. At the top, you have filed it so that you put a cartridge without any bullet in it, but it can fire like a cartridge. Mm-hmm. And then you load that with cyanide powder, I think it is. And then you put this in as like a triggering device, and you wrap this thing with the thing is the bullet is there. You wrap it around with the string and wax and stuff, and then you impregnate it with a lot of odors, and you put it down in there and turn it, and then it's set so that if something tries to pull this off, it fires this into the mouth of the coyote.
It's like pulling a cork off or something.
Yeah. It's designed so that once they get the teeth in there, the spring will, they get a good grip, and they pull it, try to pull it off, and bang, it would shoot them the cyanide right into their mouth, and it would kill them within minutes, usually. But again, you know, it was designed in Lower 48 for coyotes, but it worked on wolves and bears or other animals. Well, again, you set these things out, and then you had to go out and pick them all up before the bears came out, in theory, and there's always some you couldn't find.
Right.
And especially you walk long distances and scatter them out in the Tanana Hills, for example. And the idea was that those wolves are killing caribou and mountain sheep and moose. And yet we didn't have studies to say that those populations needed wolf control.
Well, it sounds like your deer habitat exposure research and this idea of harsh winters and depth of snow and your island comparison would show in those places you had deer starving, but they weren't being killed because of wolves.
That's true.
For all these other reasons.
That was the intent of the studies, to try to show whether there was really a need for this. But you got to realize the biologists were young college people, and here you had these old timers who were game wardens working for the same agency, and the predator and rodent control people, and they were just like old hunters. They had a lot more experience in the field, and therefore they thought they knew better about the need than we did. And we'd say, if there aren't many deer over in this area, and say, the hunters never go there, but it's probably because it's not good habitat for the deer. And we didn't have hard data, and that's a big problem, especially with winter mortality. Well, how many, if there was heavy winter mortality, the starvation, well, how many deer didn't starve? And how many did the wolves kill? We didn't have that kind of data. There was started some wolf studies, that was not through the predator and rodent control. Well, they might have got, they were, the young fellow that started those was through the Fish and Wildlife Service, and then later it was through the Department of Fish and Game after statehood,
So that was wolf studies in Southeast.
Yeah.
I don't, do you remember his name?
Yeah, Paul Garceau. And he was an undergraduate student and did an undergraduate degree here in wildlife at UAF. So I knew him as an undergraduate student, and I was doing my master's.
So once you started getting this data, did the predator control people start listening, and was that changed?
No, I think you have to remember that there was change going on in the system. It was just that a few biologists, new hires, aren't going to turn over this agency that is with long-time old employees who, especially game wardens, who interact more directly with the hunters and than we did. We're interacting more, trying to interact more with the animal and the habitat, mm-hmm. whereas they were interacting with the hunters. And it's, of course, the hunters that were having a voice in the legislature and through their representatives in the legislature, whether it's the territorial legislature or the state legislature. And so the hunters know best, and the same problem exists today in the state legislature. I think they know better how to manage wildlife than the Department of Fish and Game with trained professionals gathering this animal-habitat relationship.
Yeah.
There was, I should mention one more, this wolf study that we did down there. And I say we, sort of, anyway, I was working on the Coronation Island as well as Warren Coffey. Coronation didn't have any wolves. And it had the small deer, and they were damaged habitat over a long period of time of too many deer, no hunting pressure to speak of, and no bears, no major predators. You know, occasional eagle would kill a calf, newborn calf, and that would be about it. And so when I had pretty much finished the vegetative studies and was in the beginning of the write-up stage, but I was then on education leave down in the University of British Columbia. And then Harry Merriam was taking over this my deer studies, my deer management work, mm-hmm. and he'd work with me when I'd come back in the summer. But then the top people in the new Fish and Game Department, Jim Brooks, who was head of the game division then, who had been a student at Fairbanks, a top-notch guy who I had convinced I should, he convinced me I should go with them, and I convinced him I would, and mm-hmm. but I needed this educational leave and come back and do the studies. Well, while I was down there, they had a meeting of the biologists, and they came up with the idea. It didn't come out of the blue, but what had happened before, when Garceau, 59, let's see. Yeah, okay, so this was probably about 59 when this came up, when I was down there at UBC. Paul Garceau had been hired by Fish and Game, and he was starting some wolf studies. Well, he was on Kubernoff Island. He had a small cruiser boat, and he wanted to, someone told him, a waterfowl biologist came back from an area where there was a big estuary in about quite a ways from Petersburg, but to the west, and in a channel between Kyu and Kuprinoff Island. And John Bay, I think it was called. And so this waterfall biologist was out there doing bird counts and breeding bird counts in the spring, and he saw a lot of wolf tracks, and he heard wolves howling because of his presence in the general area. They were howling because he was there. And so he figured that there was a den with young. And so he came back to town and he told the wolf biologist about it. He went out, Paul Garceau, and he wanted to make some observations on wolves around den. And so he went to this general area. It's a big open, when the tide's out, you know, you can walk around on the mud flats and then up in some of the sloughs at the head of the, he went up there and he went through a little island of timber, and then he was told that the den was probably just opposite the island. So he went up through there, came through the woods. It was rainy, had rain gear, dark rain gear on, and he crawled out where there was a tree down, and so he'd have some cover, and he looked around and tried to, he didn't hear any, he saw tracks, but he didn't see any sign of wolves. And so he's looking with his binoculars, and apparently that den was just up, he was not where he was looking, he was just upstream.
He was looking straight, and it was up to
upstream a short distance, and suddenly, and the tide's out, so it's pretty dry in there, and he heard, he's watching, he's looking through binoculars, and suddenly he hears animals running on the dry bed of the deal. Just the sound of these running animals. And he didn't have a clue what was causing it. And he looked up, and here's the whole pack of wolves coming toward him. Down, because they had seen him and probably thought he was a black bear. And it was close to their den. And so they're probably going to try to harass it away. And so he was an excellent shot. He had a good light rifle with him. He jumps up, and these things are just coming right straight for him. And you know, so he shot one of them. And the others, as soon as he shot, they all split and ran off into the woods and were growling and howling and making all kinds of strange noises. And he was careful, and he went down, and this was a pregnant female that he had shot. And not pregnant, a nursing female. So he went up and investigated. The wolves kept their distance back in the woods, and here were these little tiny
pups,
which, you know, with mom dead. So he gathered up the pups and brought them back to Petersburg. And he took them out to there was an experimental mink ranch that had some minor connection with the university, but he said, "No, I got these, and it'd be great. We gotta feed them." And so the family out there said, "Oh, they would bottle feed them, and then they could put them in one of these fox cages when they were pups, big enough pups, and they could feed them fish meal, which they were feeding to their mink." And they had some foxes too, they're experimental for the skins that they fed the foxes, and they usually had surplus and they feed them. So that's what they did. And so Paul did start collecting information on weights and what they were eating and what. And I came back, and Harry and I, Paul went someplace else on another project, and Harry and I would go out there at first every week, and we would They had made up a big white board and had them stand on this platform. We'd weigh them individually, and then take their pictures of their size against this gridded background. Mm-hmm. And then we kept that up. We didn't go as frequently later, once a month or something. And they built, finally they got too big for these fox deals. It was like a raised with a net wire that mm-hmm. they walk on, and then they had little houses they could go in. They got too big for that, so we built a big sort of paddock with big cattle wire fence and rugged and long and narrow so they could have running room. And then they had an old fox house where they had we could go in there and put a scale in there, and then they have a trap door and feed them. They'd feed them inside, and so then we could trap them periodically and weigh them again. Mm-hmm. And we did this. They got up to be huge.
Like 100 pounds?
They got to 125 pounds.
Wow.
In less than a year of age. So they were growing well on the food that was available, and they're eating this stuff they were feeding to the...
Yeah, but that's not necessarily what they would do in the wild.
No, of course not. No, this showed the potential for growth.
Yeah.
And it was fun to go out there and do this, because you got to see different characters in the litter of six pups. There were two females and four males. And two of the males grew to the biggest size, substantially bigger than any of the others. And then two of the males that were a smaller size, this was when they're less than a year old, they acted like females in terms of being submissive to the bigger ones. But they all hung out together and were happy to be in a group and running back and forth in the deal and play behavior too. And when we would go out, finally they wouldn't go into the hut. They knew where they were going to get weighed. They didn't want to be handled too much. And so Harry and I had to catch them individually. Well, the big males didn't have to catch. They had come over and they were just like dogs. They'd put their front paws and look right in the face, and their tail would be wagging. And they're beautiful animals. And then the other, then we had problems. So we had to trick them and get them into the house, they were thinking get food, and they were getting a little, and get them in a crate, because they wouldn't stand still on the scale. Whereas the others, this was one of the big scales for weighing big things.
Right. And one of the hanging kind of scales?
No, this was had reels, and you stepped on the platform.
Okay.
And the females were real shy, and they were hard to catch. You'd have to corner them in one place and then grab them. And when you grabbed them, they'd usually would have coveralls on, and they'd usually go like that, but not squeeze hard.
They'd chomp their jaw down?
Yeah, just hold, and they were shivering, you know.
And your wrist.
And these subordinate males were the same way. And then we'd carry them in, set them on the scale, and they would stay still.
Because they were scared.
Yeah. As long as you had control over them, and then you just let go, and they would still, because we were in control of them. But the big ones wouldn't stand for this, and they would just, they just wanted to be doing their own thing and moving around. And so we had to put them in crates, and they would fight the crate. They were just tough guys. And but they never were aggressive toward us. And so then they this is worth it. I've published a paper on this. And then they, so then what to do with these? So I was back then at UBC, and they decide, well, let's do an experiment and put wolves on Coronation Island and see what it would do to the deer out there. So they all had ear tags, and they had to build special containers out of to contain these wooden crates. They just chewed their way through these aggressive males. They took the two aggressive males and two females out in separate crates. They were made out of old fuel barrels, welded to make them larger, and sealed so that they couldn't get out. And they had water and were well fed. And they calmed down when they were in dark like that. And so that was like a 4-hour trip on the boat. And took them out there and released them on Coronation Island. And they shot a couple of deer. These deer were thick there on the island, and they shot a couple of deer and left them there for the wolves to be done. And then they came back, and the wolves, went wild right away and proceeded to kill the deer. And so it's unfortunately, they didn't have a lot of money to do this. They didn't like none. You're doing it without a budget. And so Harry Merriam had all these other jobs to do. So he'd only get out there, once every month or two at the most. And he did have this one boat he could get out there, which was important. And that was seaworthy, and he could sleep on it if necessary. And so then he was following what was happening. And of course, again, you had the problem, you don't know what, you don't see them all. He'd got there and he'd see tracks, and you'd find, the deer became scarce. Mm-hmm. Some of it was they became weary because they were being preyed on, but they'd find lots of wolf kill remains scattered around the island where he did hikes. And occasionally he would see their tracks in sandy beaches and could estimate how many there were on that basis. And sometimes he'd see two or three at a time, or a single one. And they became very wary. But then he carried this on for, meantime I had finished up and I was working in Juneau, and I did get out down one time and went out with Harry. And shortly after, when I was working there in Juneau, and that was really fascinating. And about this time, and then Harry was able to show that they bred and produce a big litter. And so he estimated on the basis of tracks and what that the population got up to 15, and there was a litter. The litter was getting pretty good size, but about half grown. And then a strange thing happened. Some fisherman had pulled into one of the bays because of the bad weather, and he went for a walk on the beach, and he knew that there were deer there, and he saw these two wolves running on the beach, and he shot them. And they were the two females. Mm. And had ear tags. Well, he didn't tell anybody, of course. He couldn't understand why nobody knew about this except Fish and Game. So the public, they figured nobody's going to if we bring this out to the public, now this is an experiment, public won't see it this way. The idea of transplanting wolves to a deer island, you know, even though they didn't have, the public didn't have all the background on the island, and this guy was based in Ketchikan, and finally word leaked out that this guy had these ear tags, which said you're supposed to return these to the Fish and Wildlife Service, or Fish and Game, I guess it was. And so then it got into the press, Fish and Game? Why are they putting ear, at that stage nobody was putting ear tags in wolves? And why was there wolves on Coronation? Didn't used to have wolves. So they had to come out and explain everything. And they did. And it was, the director then, Jim Brooks, was good at that. And went down and talked to people and said, we want to know a lot of things about wolves and deer. And here was this island, and they presented all this data that I'd collected. I hadn't finished writing the thesis yet, but I had the data on the deer density and effect on vegetation, et cetera, deer size and lower growth weight. And I had a lot of skeletal measurements, because we shot some deer, and we had a permit to shoot deer to get skeletal size, and I did publication on showing how the skeletal size was indication of nutrition, and compared it to the other island where I had the similar sampling of deer, that with the big deer. And so that was one of my thesis papers, one of about four or five. And so then they calmed down the public concern. They did a good job of getting publicity out about the nature of the study, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the public accepted that, and especially because it was now classified, later on it became classified as wilderness. At that time it wasn't.
So after he shot the two female, did the population decline, and that was the end?
No, that was it. So the Harry Merriam showed that the pups were growing, and they saw them with, so the population, that leveled off at about a total of 15 animals.
Okay.
But it was mostly pups, and because it had to be mostly pups, because there were only two males, so the original left. And so they did live trap an animal on the Dacian Island, a female, and release it there.
Okay.
I think they did that. But there never was any known additional litter produced. By this time, the deer population has been greatly reduced. So, and Harry continued this work, and he would walk the island, and he wouldn't see any deer droppings or deer tracks unless he got into the real rocky coasts on one side of the island where there's real steep slopes and big boulders and brush. And this was escape terrain. And he found a few deer pellets, fresh deer pellets, and an occasional track. So that the deer weren't totally eliminated, but what was happening to the wolves, they were feeding on lots of other things. Things salvaged off the beach. One time he saw them digging clams at low tide.
Wow.
And eating the clams. Well, you could see these squirts coming up, and they probably were investigating, and they probably would do that anyway, but it wouldn't be a major, but it was becoming, and they would, there used to be a place where seals hauled out, and they killed a few seals, and then the seals stopped hauling out on one coast, rocky place. So the seals stopped hauling out there. I went back one time while it was, and went with Harry, but we were confronted with some nasty weather. There had been a Forest Service had built a cabin on there, which was used, we could use, which is a good deal. If you're out in the rain and nice with your wood stove and come back and dry out. And that, we did a long hike and nice weather in it. That first night, we camped out under overhang and the storm blew in. And getting back through that woods was terrible because you can't walk. There were several bays, and you can't see once you're in the rainforest. You can't see where it is. And it was foggy. We were going to go up on high. We decided to go up high, and because when we got high, we could cover ground better. But it wasn't too foggy. You couldn't see where you're going. And we came down and stayed up as high as we could to miss these bays. And then we had a directional problem. You know, you would think you're going in the right direction, and I thought I was familiar with the island, but there were a lot of sinkholes, you know, because of this, not bottomless, but you'd walk down and there'd be down trees and you'd have to go up and coming up in. And then we weren't getting there, and we'd covered a lot of ground, and the compass, where I was using a compass, and so we thought we were reading the compass wrong or something. It was too close to the rifle. And then the worst case scenario is when you lose confidence in the compass and the wind, and we couldn't get any break in the clouds to look out. Most places you wouldn't see out because of the trees, but some things there'd be a opening and a steep slope, and you could look out. And if we could see and recognize one of the bays, but that's finally we figured there was something wrong with the compass, and using the wind because of the storm, but we were on sort of the lee side, so you're getting a lot of turbulence, and we knew that you can't rely on wind in this case, but that was the only thing that we could. Once we lost confidence in the compass, that's what we did. And then finally, there was a break, and we looked down, and whoop, there was a bay. And so we were heading in the right direction, and we had one more bay to go. And so we got over and got back. And when we got back and we got the map out and looked down at the fine print on this map, it said there was a magnetic anomaly in this island. I didn't even... I never thought about that before, and it was just in this one portion of the island. So that's what screwed us up. At any rate, it was a memorable trip.
Yeah, it sounds like it.
And, when I'd hiked through that country and never had that happen to me before and relied on the compass, and we didn't have GPS in those days, and you relied on everything you could read, but... This.
Well, and it's not like there were nice cut trails and.
Yeah, and the problem is you thought you knew the country. And if you're perfectly flat, that's different. Here you're hilly country, and we knew we were on the right side of the island. That's because we weren't being hit by the full force of the storm.
And also heavily wooded down there.
Yeah.
So what's ended up happening with those
Okay,
winds?
Then what happened is that, you know, we should have, they should have, because I wasn't there making the decision, but I followed up on this. In the meantime, Harry went through a period when he broke up with his wife and became an alcoholic. And he quit. Well, he didn't want to quit at first, but fishing came down hard on him, and finally they gave him ultimatums, and he quit. And he and his wife, who stuck with him, this was his second wife. He had built this beautiful log cabin and bought some land right across in West Petersburg, so you have to go there by boat. So he moved over there, and so he just didn't want anything to do with the fish and game for a while after that, and he would give me information, and I said, well, look, let's write this thing out as much as we can, because the wolves finally, they were finally declined. There were no more litters born, and that was a fact, partly because there were no deer.
Well, we figured they ate themselves out of house and home, sort of. They
yeah, that's
ate
right.
all the deer, and then they're yeah. digging for clams, and they're going to start starving.
They couldn't starve. And there was indications even of carnivory and the wolf droppings eating other wolves. And then I was, one of the last times I was out there with him, we saw two wolves, and one was, and they were probably the last two, one was, looked healthy, the other one looked real run down. And then there was, he had seen one, the last one he saw, was able to verify when the tracks, only one, and it was a female. And the last one he saw was a female. And then it disappeared.
And what about what time period is this when they were disappearing?
From the introduction to the end?
Yeah.
Must be 9 or 10 years.
Okay.
But I don't know. That's in the paper. And I ended up publishing this paper because Harry says he did not want. Oh, there was a wolf conference, and I said, you know, we should do it together, and he didn't. And I lost touch with him for quite a while, and then I went. I wasn't getting into Petersburg. I was at the wildlife unit, and I. Occasionally, when I get down there, I would get to see him again. But he spent most of his time across, and he went over by a skiff. And then he quit alcohol completely. But he split up with his wife, and she was this kind of strange person. She was a biologist, and she was employed in office. Actually, I had employed her. When I was working in Juneau as some kind of a secretarial assistant or mm-hmm. something. She had a degree in biology, and she was a very terrific, fine person, but she was kind of screwed up with some strange religion she got down in Petersburg.
Well, so I think we should probably end pretty soon here, because it's... Right. You've had to talk for a long time tonight.
I know,
but I have one question that to sort of end this topic, maybe. You'd mentioned that even as the biologist with the management issues, you went and talked to hunters. I'm wondering how that went and how you got along with the hunters and how they felt about these biologists.
Well, the fellow, Sig Olson, who preceded me, you know, that he did a lot of laying groundwork, because he was up against the same problems. You know, Harry was a college graduate, and he grew up in Lake of the Woods country.
Minnesota?
Yeah. His father was Sigurd F. Olson, wrote, you probably...
I've heard of him, yes.
Yeah. And he's had the same personality as his father. He wasn't a writer, but... He was a good artist, and he was a wonderful sense of humor, fun guy to work with, and I just enjoyed him a lot. At any rate, I had instructions from him how to proceed, and I'm a quick learner, and I got to know people, and they'd have scheduled meetings for the public, which would be mainly hunters, about proposals for regulations in which I would explain what I was doing. And, you know, have charts and tables, the age of the average age of the deer that were killed by hunters, and the sex ratios, and how this related to the growth and the population pyramids, and showed that it was a vigorous growing population at that time, and compared it to a slow growing population. And I guess I'm kind of outgoing and also modest enough so that I was good listeners when I talked to hunters, and I tried to get as much information from them as possible. So I knew that that's good. Hunters are good sources of information, and, you know, well, how many deer did you see, and did you see any cows or females with young, and, you know, and they would let me measure their animals, and I was taking measurements on their hind foot length, and I was using that as based on the bones too, mm-hmm. but the hind foot length, and used that, and they had published this paper on it, and sort of to show the growth rate in relation to body size, and I could explain the difference in size of the deer on Warenkovsky and Coronation. Well, if some of them may have never hunted on both of those islands, but they might have known about them, and they hunted. They were ardent hunters, and I write article when they. Then we finally did get a big snow, and deer were down on the beach, and the wrangle hunters got the idea. Oh, well, let's feed them. Let's cut down. Go up on the Stikine and cut down willows and aspen, and none growing out on the islands, and bring them in and feed the deer. Mm. And so I wrote this long deal in the newspapers, you know, saying, yeah, explaining how this had been done, tried down in the lower 48, and it's not a good deal because the animals can't respond rapidly if they're starving to good food. And they wanted to try to get hay and things like that in. And they can't respond rapidly to a different kind of food because they have these microorganisms. I had to go through all of this, you know, explaining the microorganisms and the rumen and how they worked and how they need time to adapt, and that frequently that's too late when they're down on the beach and they're eating seaweed and the needles of the western hemlock from trees that they could have eaten when they're healthy, but they didn't. Mm-hmm. And that you concentrate the animals in one area. So if there's any natural food available, and it's the same in Africa, if you try to concentrate animals around a watering hole or with food, and in Europe, the same way we're trying to feed red deer and stuff in the wintertime, you got to start feeding early, and you got to feed them all the time, and because they're now domestic animals. Right. And so, and I went over to Wrangell and talked to the people, and there was a good school teacher there who was just, you know, he just cornered me and trying to get all more information, and he said, "Oh, that's terrific." And he said, because hunters keep contacting him. He was an ardent hunter, but he had a good education, and so I built up confidence in the people on the kind of studies we're doing, and I wasn't there was no need to curtail hunting, and so it. You know, it wasn't a...
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right that if you had been in a situation where hunting was threatened and those hunters were feeling constrained, there might have been some conflict right. between the biologist and the hunter.
And then they knew I was also having problems in trying to get the Forest Service to protect these wintering areas of old growth forests along the beach, which the small loggers loved that because it was so close they didn't have to build roads. They could just use an A-frame and a cable and take these big, beautiful spruce, mainly, but also hemlock, and make their build the rafts right there. That one a person with a fishing boat, and they build the A-frame, and they can haul their any materials they need from town, and they camp out there. And they might have a shore camp, and they use cables. In fact, the old, real old logging was hand loggers.
Right.
And that was just one aspect of their life. They were trappers, fishermen, hand loggers. Good money. You take down one spruce, and if you can get it to fall in the water and at a high tide and drag it to the sawmill, you get several thousand dollars from one log.
So those old guys were your allies in trying to protect the old growth forest?
Yeah, although most of them were no longer alive, but there were a few left, but there was so few of them that, and they didn't want to, they were more recluses.
Oh, okay.
But they were good guys to talk to, and other hunters talked to them, and you could, you know, if you told other hunters, they knew them. Yeah, most of the hunters were coming from longtime families that, and they were financially well off because they were salmon fishermen.
Mm, okay.
And the Wrangell people were mostly gill netters on the Stikine, the mouth of Stikine, which is good. And it was, they made their money like Cordova in one big shot in the summer. Some of them didn't fish anymore all winter long. Petersburg were totally different. There's a Norwegian fisherman. They were so dedicated fishermen, and they worked so hard, they had bigger, better boats, and they could use boats. They could go halibut fishing in Bering Sea from Petersburg. When the halibut season opened, they could hunt, they could fish for black cod, you know, black cod?
Mm-hmm.
And it's a terrific fish, and it brings big money. And,
oh, I didn't know that.
And it has a lot of oil in it. It's quite unrelated to codfish.
Right.
And then it fished for herring, so there was a shrimp fisherman there, fishery, but it's small and only one or two boats, but caught quite a few shrimp, and they had a fish processing plant in Petersburg.
Right.
Shrimp processing plant, as well as halibut and salmon, and a cannery, and Wrangell had a sawmill too, a big sawmill. So the economy there was in pretty good shape, the attitude of hunters about, of course, in Wrangell. They wanted to harvest wood for the mill and for their jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But the Forest Service had convinced, of course, legislators that, you know, pulp mills, the way to go was this future of Petersburg, is, and all depended upon the rayon industry in Japan, mostly that. The pulp mills, they produced this fiber board that went back and they could make rayon out of it.
Oh, I didn't know that.
And it was not as good as nylon for clothing and things, or as cotton or wool, but it was cheap. I could do that.
But so because the economy was pretty good down there, the hunters had animals to kill, everybody was sort of getting along with each other?
Yeah.
Is that what you're getting at?
Yeah, because it was mainly just deer hunting that fishermen did. I mean, some of them might occasionally hunt bear or go up on Stikine and hunt moose, but those are so limited, and animals, they inhabit that area, and animals that, you know, there was competition.
Mm-hmm.
Too much, and most hunters down there for deer hunting, you never went ashore with your skiff to go hunting if there was another skiff on that shoreline. You just didn't want to be in the same area with the
right.
other hunters. And one of them is safety, but the other one is that it's always the idea that you're competing. Someone's competing with you.
Right.
Maybe the other people are going to get the buck.
Mm-hmm. Well, and I was thinking that the hunters might be more willing to cooperate with the biologist and share information if they didn't feel like their hunting was being threatened.
Yeah.
Is that how it felt?
That's true. That's true. And there were still a few holdouts who believed that that there shouldn't be... You shouldn't kill the females. The buck law was, you know, the buck law was there until after the Second World War was when the of course in some places around communities most of the young men were off in the war, and so there wasn't much hunting. And so deer around communities increased.
Mm-hmm.
And then when Sig Olson was employed, the first deer biologist down there, he was, you know, didn't make sense to have a buck law, that there were too many deer, and you can't really sell too many deer to a hunter, but you can sell them that there's no need to, and then you have to work hard to say there's too many deer, because they like a lot of deer when they're out hunting, and to be able to pick and choose and be sure that you're going to get your deer if they're going out that way, and it's hard to sell them. That's why things like exclosures were necessary. And you had to add some hard evidence and then work with them and make presentations frequently with slideshows, that kind of thing. And I did that.
Right.
And I did it in other towns too, in Juneau and Ketchikan occasionally when I had opportunities to get there.
Well, it sounds great. I think that's maybe a good place to stop.
Yep.
For tonight. And next time we'll move into postgraduate school and what you did after that. Does that sound okay?
Yep.
Okay, thank you very much.